Welcome back to the TFDI podcast brought to you by the Trade Finance Distribution Initiative. Here, as you know, we discuss trade finance market trend and the evolution of the originate-to-distribute model. Today we receive Suresh Hegde. He's the head of structured private debt at NN Investment Partners, or NNIP, which just recently added a new trade finance fund to its portfolio. Suresh will talk us through the logic of this decision and why trade finance is a key part of the ESG finance ecosystem. Suresh, thank you so much for being here. So NNIP launched its new trade finance fund at the end of 2020. So I'm curious to know if this is the first time that your investors have had access to trade finance assets.
Well, yes and no. We started looking into the financing of production and sale of goods probably 10 years ago or so, when we started our export finance strategy. And we concentrated initially on medium-term lending opportunities, and they're supporting kind of more complex goods like planes, ships, infrastructure, etc., and usually with the involvement of an export credit agency. But it's a similar kind of concept. It's supporting the production and manufacture and movement of goods from one place to another, often internationally. And about 5 years ago, we got interested in shorter dated, getting closer towards traditional trade finance. So they're kind of more like working capital solutions. And we developed what we call our ITRN strategy, which is kind of insured trade receivable notes. Many of our investors are European insurance companies, and I think it's pretty clear from their regulation that rolling these kind of short-dated exposures is a very capitally efficient and therefore very attractive from an investment proposition case. So it's been very well received, and I think the route into traditional commodity trade finance was just the next logical step for us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So from an investment, from an investor's point of view, what's the difference between export finance, commodity finance, and trade finance assets? And what are some of the specific challenges that are associated with trade finance specifically?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, that they're all forms of cross-border secured kind of asset-based finance. But the main difference is, well, non-surprisingly, really what you're financing and the flow of goods and the nature of that. So in export finance, you know, you're supporting the production of, for example, the development of a ship, the building of a ship, the development of a wind farm. And so therefore, the production cycle can extend into numerous years, and the debt repayment can also be quite long. So in that business, we normally work together with ECAs, so export credit agencies, and we get a government guarantee on top. So from the investor's perspective, they end up with something that has government risk and is medium term. And so they usually think about it as a nice, efficient way to substitute government bonds exposure. Now, in trade finance, you're obviously getting into different types of assets that you're financing. And so basically, you're going to be financing a sales contract or something relating to the production of a commodity or a trade receivable. And therefore, they naturally have much, much shorter life cycles. And so you're thinking under a year. For the majority. And as I said, that's a very efficient way of financing stuff, specifically for insurance companies. And so we make use of extensive security packages, insurance, bank guarantees, LCs, but you essentially end up with something which is short-dated credit risk. And so investors are thinking about that as an interesting substitute for IG credit, maybe high yield, or even as a way to park cash. I think that they're all pretty attractive in their own different ways, but you have to think about how an investor thinks about it, or where it fits on their balance sheet, and what's the relative value. So, if we're thinking about the challenges in trade finance, well, you do end up in some pretty exotic locations. There are a lot of moving parts, quite literally. There are a lot of parties involved, so it's complexity really. But I think specifically about operational risk and controlling fraud risk, specifically at the moment in times of economic stress. Obviously, you tend to see more cases of fraud, or at least people's practices kind of get shown out a little bit more. So investing in a way where we can control that risk was a key consideration in how we designed the sourcing strategy, but also portfolio construction. So in essence, we on purpose invest in a way where we can leverage off the operational setup of banks where we can share risk with professional counterparties, and where we can do a thorough analysis on every single transaction we look at as an individual investment opportunity with its own merits.
Interesting. Okay. So one of the specificities of the trade finance fund that you recently launched is that it integrates ESG criteria, right? With the application of these criteria designed specifically for the trade finance asset class. So can you talk to us a little bit about what kind of ESG assessment you have implemented and how exactly you integrate this assessment in investment decisions?
Yeah, sure. I think it starts from the same place. So that was also part of a consideration about why we do this portfolio construction the way we do. Because I think it was pretty clear from us at the beginning that, you know, in order to do a proper assessment from ESG, specifically when you're talking about things like commodities and you're moving internationally, that you need to really be able to look in nuance and context at each transaction. So that's why we've never participated in, for example, a portfolio trade or risk transfer from a bank. You need to look at each angle on itself. Specifically for commodities, I mean, when you're thinking about the production angle of commodity, I think it's realistic to say that in almost all commodities are problematic from an environmental perspective at production phase. But it's also important for us to understand what they're being utilized for, and because I mean, to see both sides of the picture is how you get that fully nuanced picture of ESG. So essentially, you can start off with something which is environmentally problematic. Obviously, we want to make sure that it's any kind of risk there is mitigated, and we encourage improvements of people producing commodities. But on the other hand, utilization of commodities can be very environmentally and socially beneficial. So look, for example, at base metals in the renewable sector. You need copper for solar panels, you need steel for windmills, you need nickel for electric batteries, etc. So for us, it's very important that we kind of take the full nuanced picture and look at it from all angles.
Okay, I see. We've heard before that it is quite difficult to apply ESG criteria or an ESG lens to trade finance assets. But at the same time, as you mentioned just now, it's also very important. So how do you handle this complexity in your day-to-day operations?
Yeah, well, I mean, as I just described, it's a little bit about philosophy about how you do portfolio construction to give yourself the time to look at the asset from both sides, production and utilization. But it's also, you know, there's no broadly recognized or consistent standards in the industry. Data is quite hard to come by. So I think that's a little bit of the things that people struggle with. But that being said, you know, you cannot participate in the market as a professional, responsible investor without doing your homework on ESG. So we developed our own proprietary scorecard, and it lets us measure and report to clients on the ESG profile of every asset we finance. And we do this with three steps. So the first step we start with, which is called neutral scoring. And essentially there, we're looking at country risk scoring. We use our own proprietary ESG factor model there to look at each individual country. And then we've brought in some specific proprietary data on commodity risk for ESG factors, and we stick them together, and that's the part of the neutral scoring. So it gives us an initial view of the transaction without taking a kind of a view on anything. The next step is to look at who we're financing. So we look at the borrower. We have a borrower questionnaire, and there we're interested to understand, you know, how the borrower thinks about, you know, what's their ESG policy, how can we score that. Directionality and momentum is also extremely important in ESG scoring, because, you know, we don't want to just finance the people who are already doing it well. The idea is we're trying to move people who potentially not doing it so well in the right direction, because that's how you create actual improvement. And then lastly, it's about that nuance that I was discussing before. So the last bit is a kind of contextual analysis, where we start to think about, you know, what is the good being used for? Where can we see maybe socially beneficial, environmentally beneficial aspects there? And we stick it all together, and out comes a score at the end. And I think it's transparent, and it allows our investors to think about relative value of ESG in each between different investment opportunities. But I think more importantly, it's a fundamental part of the way we do our investment process. So actually, this ESG scoring ends up as a supporting factor of our internal rating that we can provide. And that's a really interesting angle for me, because you know, a lot of the questions you get sometimes from banks or investors are, how does this affect economics? And I think most people kind of start from the position of, okay, well, if I'm going to have a positive ESG environment, it's going to negatively impact my economic profile. And it's definitely not the case. And specifically, if you bake it into your ratings, it means that immediately, if you take credit for it in the ratings, you're going to have to hold less capital for your asset. And obviously, that's economically beneficial, but also from a responsible investing perspective, beneficial.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You mentioned this ESG scorecard. I wonder what the result of it is. Is this just to make a yes or no decision on the investment, or does it come into play in a more integrated way?
No, it's fully integrated. So it's a relative scoring. It's not supposed to come out with a black and white thing. And it basically comes into the discussion that we have at credit committee on each individual aspect. So it's a part of the discussion we have, along with any other type of risk return that you have in the transaction.
Okay, that's great. You've mentioned the lack of data in the industry, and we've heard a lot about that, especially when it comes to ESG. So how could industry initiatives, I guess like the TFDI, which you're a part of, help the sector move towards a more ESG conscious trade finance investments?
Well, I mean, in addition to the technology and the distribution angle of this platform, I think one of the obvious benefits is indeed about standardization, developing industry best practice and indeed sharing data on ESG, because a lot of people are collecting stuff, but no one is kind of speaking to each other, and certainly not in a consistent way. So the way this platform kind of brings market participants together from all parts of the trade finance value chain really lets us kind of discuss these items in a very kind of open environment and really think about how to improve stuff from a responsible investing perspective. And I think it makes it far easier than if we were to meet ourselves in a transactional environment where everyone's fighting their own corner. So I think this is exactly this kind of initiative that can help standardization across the market for this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So I hope it continues to help the development of these ESG investments in the future. I don't know if you listened to the podcast before, but I like to end on a more personal note. And I always ask my guests to share anything that they've read or heard recently that sparked their interest. And it doesn't have to be trade finance related, but it can be if you prefer. So would you be able to quickly share the latest thing that sparked your curiosity?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't touch on the kind of negative thing, but I find it's difficult not to speak about at the moment. The whole Greensill debacle has been quite difficult to stay away from. And to be honest, it's a bit like a car crash, and the whole story gets more and more peculiar. But you know, as a professional investor, kind of in trade finance, I think it's also been pretty painful to see what's been going on there linked to the much safer, robust, resilient types of trade finance that most of the other participants in this initiative are involved with. But on the positive note, our clients have been extremely supportive. I mean, they understand that what we do is very different. We've actually had a number of clients sign up to our strategies in Q1 as this whole thing was going on, which is really, really great, because normally you would expect everyone just to put their pens down. So they really, I mean, so people understand that, you know, that there is difference in it. And I think we continue to see that, clients see value in how we construct portfolios and value in trade finance in general as an institutionally investable asset class.
That's great. So you haven't noticed an overall negative effect on your business based on this?
We've answered a lot of questions, but no, people understand what we're doing is different. I think that's very, very, that's really great to see.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, great to know. All right. Well, we've gone through all the questions that I had for you. So thank you very much for sharing your insights with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.